voice that dares not face new truth. From the laziness that is contented with half-truth. From the arrogance that thinks it knows all truth. Good Lord, deliver us. Amen. In the summer of 2007, we had a particularly bad drought here in North Carolina. Now, I'm not sure how much you noticed it here in North Raleigh, but in the church I was serving at the time, which was a farming community, a drought was a pretty big deal. And everyone and everything was looking for water. I recall one summer afternoon in particular. I was in the church office and had just finished printing off the bulletins for that week. And I went out to put them in the entranceway to the church, and as I came out, I looked up the aisle and was going to walk up it, and I saw a snake coming down the aisle. Actually, it did turn out to be a water moccasin coming up and rearing its head in the middle of the church aisle. And many of you know I don't like snakes. And so there I had a cell phone in my back pocket. I pulled it out. I called the trustee chair, and I just screamed into the phone, "Get to the church fast and bring something that kills." Now, I didn't clarify what it is I wanted him to kill, and so he showed up with a shovel, a knife, and a shotgun. North Carolina trustee chair, gotta love it. And so he was well-armed in moments there and comes in, and needless to say, if that snake was planning to give his life to Jesus that day, well, he didn't do it by coming up to the altar. But it was just one of those seasons, one of those times where it seemed that everywhere you looked, it was dry and thirsty and parched and desperate. And that's the kind of season and the kind of time we're encountering in the Exodus text for today. For it says that the Israelite people were thirsty. They were desperate for water to drink. They were going to Moses and demanding water to drink. Here they thought they were going to be living their lives in a promised land, flowing with milk and honey, and yet now they find that they can't even have water. Now, I have to admit, this is a section of Exodus where we seem to encounter the Hebrew people on a litany of complaints. In fact, this passage is sometimes referred to as the fourth complaint. So there's this thought that, man, these Israelites, they just keep griping, one after another after another. And yet when I look at this gripe, it is one saying, we are thirsty. It is not we want a horse and pony show or we want some sort of elaborate show of God's action. We simply want water. They want to have their most basic physical needs met. They want their children to have water. They want their elderly to have water. They want their most vulnerable to have water. They thirst. It's a pretty basic human need, a basic request that they are asking of Moses and of God. And I have to admit, while I personally, living in this place and time, have not had many times in my life where I have thirsted and not been able to go to a water fountain or get a cup of water or purchase water, there is another physical need that I have run into, one that I have wanted desperately and not been able to have, and that is sleep. When you have three children, sleep can be fleeting. When you have bouts of insomnia or sickness or anxiety or frustrations, there are times where I find I can't sleep. And I know in conversation with some of you, you find that as well. And when that lack of sleep happens night after night after night after night, I'm not a nice pastor. And I suspect that you're not particularly nice either. It just adds up. And you become desperate and irritable and frustrated. And I kind of feel like that would be the picture of the people that Moses is talking to on this day. People who are perpetually feeling this physical want, this desire, this thirst. And in the point in time where they're yelling at their leader, they have hit a wall. They just can't stand it anymore. And on top of this deep physical want for water, just a most basic human need, you have compounding this kind of existential want of direction. Again, they thought when they were in slaves in Egypt, that when they were in this new promised land, they would be living in communities and free and developing schools and businesses and homes. And yet it's nothing like they thought. Egypt wasn't great, but at least there they knew what they were going to do every day. It was harsh and it was cruel, but they knew what to expect. They knew what little food they would receive. They knew what sparse homes they would be part of, but they had stability and they knew what to expect. And now, this text, Exodus 17, is something like 2 months into what turned into 40 years of wandering. Now, they're nomads. Now, they're listless. Now, they have no direction. They have no understanding of where their food is going to come from, what their day is going to look like, what their community is about. They thought they'd be building homes and lives, but really, they're just in survival mode. And there seems to be no end in sight. And there's this want for more stability. There's this want for more community. There's want of direction and routine and stability. And again, I can't specifically relate to that, but I can say that when I look back on my life, the phase that was the most wandering was the one right after college. For up until college, I had lived in a world that was pretty clearly defined for me, whether it was defined by my parents or by the schools or by the grade systems or by that list of extracurriculars you're supposed to be involved in. I pretty much knew what I was supposed to do every day. I pretty much knew what was expected of me. And then you hit that season and there's this great graduation and they give you a diploma and then ta-da, you got the real world. And you have rent. And you have groceries, and you have work, and nobody's trying to offer you a grade. Nobody's looking over your shoulder. Nobody's giving you advice. It is a season of wandering where you have to figure it out. And I remember it being hard. I wanted somebody to say, wow, you would have made this grade today, but it's not going to happen. And I feel like we're in this compounded season where these people have both had this deep want, this physical want of thirst, and now they have this additional want of they don't know what any day is going to look like. They don't know what the purpose is. They don't know the reason and the why. They have these promises out there that they've heard a lot about, but they're not seeing it. Instead, they're just wandering around. And so you have these wants of the Hebrew people. And then you have this picture of Moses in this passage, and he's in a place of want as well. He's been with these people. He's led these people. He's heard their stories. He's heard their belly aching. He's heard their celebrations. And now he gets to this point, and they're turning on him, and they're yelling at him, and they're complaining. And I love how he says when he cries out to God, help me with these people, how he notes these people. He doesn't say my people. He says these people. It's like when I'm really fed up with the kids, and I look at my husband, and I say, what should we do with these children? They're not my children. Or our children, they're these children. I need enough distance from them. And so you see Moses is distancing himself from the people. What am I going to do, God, with these people? They are going to stone me. They are fed up. I need your help. I want your leadership and your help. I want you to help me in this situation so that I can lead these people to the promised land. And this is kind of the classic entry point for any frustrated pastor. Any pastor who has seen the vision and seen the plan and seen the hope for a group of people and it feels so frustrated and says, God, you put me in this position and now they're turning on me. What do I do? I love what I do, but there are times it's challenging. I was talking to Lucas earlier about kind of looking forward on ministry. He's a first year in seminary and what is to come. And, you know, you expect that you're going to be preaching and teaching and leading funerals and weddings and experiencing. But I can just promise you, you're going to have a carpet controversy. I know. Jesus talks a lot about this. But no, you do face this. I think I face this at every church I've served. It's carpet or something else, but it's basically carpet. Usually it's carpet. And I recall particularly one place where months and months of meetings with trustees, where we had, you know, late night, really feverish and intense discussions over carpet color and texture and how it would rub and putting samples out and you had to walk on it. I mean, really, you know, amazing how many decisions have to be made about carpet. And after months and months and months, we finally made a decision. We finally were going to install the carpet. And of course, this was, you know, Jesus was coming. Like, it was huge. Everything had to be changed. Everything had to be taken out of the sanctuary. All the furniture moved. Meetings were changed. We talked to everybody, told them nobody could die that week because we couldn't have their funeral in the sanctuary if they did. So, you know, we laid the groundwork as much as we could. The carpet comes in. And then that Sunday, the great reveal Sunday, and the first lady in the church comes in. She looks around and says, "Oh, the carpet looks nice." I thought, okay. And she said, "Actually, I think it looks too nice. We're a simple church. We don't need nice carpet like this." And I'm thinking, really, God? Really? Sometimes leading people to the promised land is just so hard. We want help. You have these people who have wants. You have Moses who has a clear want. And then into all of this, that's a universal want that's not just of the people or just of Moses. You have this one haunting line that comes at the end when Moses says he's going to label this place and he's going to label this time as this place in time where they looked to God and said, "Is the Lord among us or not?" And if you were going to say, if there's any one want that is more timeless or more haunting, more universal, it's this one. Is the Lord among us or not? We want to know. We want to know if God is present. We want to know if God is with us. We want to know if God is in us and in this time and in this season. We want to know it just so badly. I find as I think on my prayers that I give, whether it's the pastoral prayer in church, prayers over a prayer shawl or in a hospital room, that often as I think back on the words that I use in those prayers, my most repeated and sincere prayer is one where I say to God, "Please, God, make your presence known without a doubt." I don't know how many times I've said those words, without a doubt. We want to know with certainty that you are in this marriage, you're in this workplace, you are in this family, you are in this church meeting, you are in this hospital room. We want to know, please God, make your presence known clear, definitively, without a doubt. It's the same echo through time. Is the Lord with us or not? It's our deepest want. And so this text has all these wants in it, from physical wants to leadership wants to this universal cry of wanting to know God is present. And the paradox here is, how do we find relief from these wants? How do we find fulfillment from these wants? The paradox here is, we first have to experience the wants, experience their depth and their breadth and their claim upon us, so that we can see that God is the one that fulfills all those wants definitively and eternally and forever. It's a paradox that we've seen repeated thus far in the Lenten season. In Lent, the first Sunday in Lent, we talked about temptation. We talked about the way that we overcome temptation by facing those things that tempt us. In the second week of Lent, we talked about darkness. And again, the power of darkness and the way that we can see the light is to put ourselves and to recognize the claim of the darkness on us so that we can see the light shining through. And so it's not surprising here in week three, we see the same paradox at work. That if we want to understand relief and fulfillment in that next stage and know that our wants and our deepest desires and our requests and our claims will be answered by God, We have to first recognize what those wants are and put ourselves, as the sermon is titled, in a place of want. Appropriately, in Lent, people often adopt a Lenten discipline, classically understood as something that you give up for Lent. It is a way that we can say we're going to put ourselves in a place of want because we're going to give up something that we want, whether it be a certain food or candy or habit or technology or some kind of device, whatever it is that we know that we want that's getting away from our relationship from God, we put it away in the Lenten disciplines and experience that want and realize that these are just earthly wants. And that God fulfills all our wants. And in putting ourselves in that place of want, we realize the true answer that God gives, the opportunity that God gives, the promise that God gives, the deliverance that God gives. We're allowed to shift. For if you look at this passage, Exodus 17, in most Bibles, a lot of Bibles have those little titles at the top of the passage, and none of them say, Exodus 17, a litany of wants. Now, if you look at Exodus 17, in every Bible version I looked at for this sermon preparation, they were all titled the same, Water from Rock. Totally different shift. The passage does not focus on the wants of the people. The passage focuses on God's fulfillment. They wanted water. That was the first, most basic request. We thirst. And Moses, God told Moses to take the staff and to take that staff in a way that was wondrous and miraculous and awesome and cool. He hits that rock and water starts gushing forth. And that water comes forward. And they know in that moment not only will their physical thirst be filled, but they know that a God who is capable of that is the God who is capable of bringing them to the promised land and giving them the community they desired. The God who is capable of that is the God who is capable of telling Moses that you have it in you to lead these people, to teach them what they need to know. The God that is capable of bringing the water from the rock is the God who's showing without a doubt that God is present, that God does matter, that God is part of this story and will end up victorious. So while I'm focusing on the wants, God doesn't focus on the wants. God shows that he will be the one to fulfill all our needs and all our desires, and that God does that. Now, we like to travel a good bit around North Carolina when we have opportunities, and you all know I'm a Methodist minister. Most of you know I'm married to a Catholic, and so in our travels, we tend to pull over and visit different churches. Both Methodist and Catholic. One that still sticks with me, and one I would very much encourage you to see, is Belmont Abbey. It's a Catholic church, Catholic Abbey, in Charlotte. And if you're ever in the area, go in and visit, because when you walk in to the entranceway, it has the most extraordinary baptismal font. It is a baptismal font that is fashioned out of a large, rough rock. And if you get up close, you can read the inscription on this baptismal font in Belmont Abbey. The words are, "Upon this rock, men once were sold into slavery. Now upon this rock, through the waters of baptism, men become free children of God." It is a modern water out of rock experience. You take a look at that rock and you realize that there were men and women. Who knows how the abbey acquired it, but the fact is that is a slave trading block, and men and women stood upon it and they cried out, "Is the Lord among us? Is the Lord with me? I want to know. I want to know if my basic physical needs are going to be met. I want to know that there is a God. I want to know that there is help." They cried those words in their hearts and in their minds and maybe even in their mouths upon that very rock. And that same rock is now fashioned into a baptismal, so that generations and generations can come and feel the waters come through it and know that God answered the wants of all times in the baptismal waters and the promise of new life in the death, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, in that moment, in that symbolism, in that sacrament, we find our wants fulfilled. We find our answers. The human condition is one of perpetual want. We're going to face it again and again and again, and we're going to experience those wants in new ways. And yet, through the grace of Jesus Christ, we are not bound to the human condition and to this experience of perpetual wants. We know more. We know hope. We know promise. We know deliverance. We know that water can come from rock. Glory to God. Amen.